Consider the receptionist at a publishing company I visited a week later. There she was, doing nothing, sitting at a desk, minding her own business, bored out of her skull. She acknowledged that the front office is very slow and that she just sits there, reading romance novels and waiting. And she's been doing it for 2 years. Or consider the MBA student I met yesterday who is taking a job at a major packaged goods company because they offered her a great salary and promised her a well-known brand. She's going to stay, quote, for just 10 years, then have a baby and leave and start my own gig, unquote. She'll get really good at running coupons in the Sunday paper, but not particularly good at solving new problems. What a waste. Step one is to give the problem a name. Sheepwalking. Done. Step two is for those of you who see yourself in this mirror to realize that you can always stop. You can always claim the career you deserve merely by refusing to walk down the same path as everyone else just because everyone else is already doing it. The biggest step, though, comes from anyone who teaches or hires, and that's to embrace non-sheep behavior, to reward it and cherish it. As we've seen, just about everywhere there's been growth lately is where the good stuff happens. You know, reading these paragraphs aloud, I'm betting some people will think I'm being way too harsh. That depends. It depends on whether you believe that people have a considerable amount of innate potential, that work is too time-consuming to be dull, and that organizations need passion from employees and from customers if they want to grow into tribes and movements. It depends on whether you believe that the relationship between marketers and the people they touch is important enough to invest in. I think if you believe all that, if you believe in yourself and your coworkers, then this isn't nearly harsh enough. We need to hurry. We need to wake up. How was your day? It's 4 a.m. and I can't sleep, so I'm sitting in the lobby of a hotel in Jamaica, checking my email. A couple walks by, obviously on their way to bed, having pushed the idea of vacation a little too hard. The woman looks over to me, and in a harsh whisper, a little quieter than a yell, says to her friend, "Isn't that sad? That guy comes here on vacation, and he's stuck checking his email. He can't even enjoy his 2 weeks off." I think the real question, the one they probably wouldn't want to answer, was, "Isn't it sad that we have a job where we spend 2 weeks avoiding the stuff we have to do 50 weeks a year?" It took me a long time to figure out why I was so happy to be checking my email in the middle of the night. It had to do with passion. Other than sleeping, there was nothing I'd rather have been doing in that moment, because I'm lucky enough to have a job where I get to make change happen. Even though I don't have many people working for me, I'm in the business of leading people, taking them somewhere we want to go. On the other hand, most people have jobs, for now, where they fight change, where they work overtime to defend the status quo. It's exhausting. Maintaining a system in the face of change will grind you down. Think for a second about the people you know who are engaged, satisfied, eager to get to work. Most of them, I'll bet, make change. They challenge the status quo and push something forward, something they believe in. They lead. "Life's too short" is repeated often enough to be a cliche, but this time it's true. You don't have enough time to be both unhappy and mediocre. It's not just pointless, it's painful. Instead of wondering when your next vacation is, maybe you ought to set up a life you don't need to escape from. The amazing thing is that not only is this sort of life easier to set up than ever before, but it's also more likely to make you successful and happy. So, how was your day? The thermometer and the thermostat. A thermostat is far more valuable than a thermometer. The thermometer reveals that something is broken. The thermometer is an indicator, our canary in the coal mine. Thermometers tell us when we're spending too much or gaining market share or not answering the phone quickly enough. Organizations are filled with human thermometers. They can criticize or point out or just whine. The thermostat, on the other hand, manages to change the environment in sync with the outside world. Every organization needs at least one thermostat. These are leaders who can create change in response to the outside world and do it consistently over time. Your micro-movement. This is the heart of the matter. Every leader cares for and supports a movement. A movement like the free speech movement at Berkeley, or the democracy movement in Tiananmen Square, or the civil rights movement in Mississippi. Or maybe a movement like the obsession with hand-roasted coffee in Brooklyn, or the worldwide collection of people obsessed with tattoos. Today, you can have a narrow movement, a tiny movement, a movement in a silo. Your movement can be known by 10 or 20 or 1,000 people, people in your community, or people around the world. And most often, it can be the people you work with or for, or those that work for you. The web connects people. That's what it does. And movements take connected people and make change. What marketers and organizers and people who care are discovering is that they can ignite a micro-movement and then be propelled by the people who choose to follow it. The key elements in creating a micro-movement consist of 5 things to do and 6 principles. 1. Publish a manifesto. Give it away and make it easy for the manifesto to spread far and wide. It doesn't have to be printed or even written, but it's a mantra and a motto and a way of looking at the world. It unites your tribe members and gives them a structure. 2. Make it easy for your followers to connect with you. It could be as simple as visiting you or emailing you or watching you on television. Or it could be as rich and complex as interacting with you on Facebook or joining your social network on Ning. 3. Make it easy for your followers to connect with one another. There's that little nod that one restaurant regular gives to another recognized regular, or the shared drink in an airport lounge. Even better is the camaraderie developed by volunteers on a political campaign or insiders involved in a new product launch. Great leaders figure out how to make these interactions happen. 4. Realize that money is not the point of a movement. Money exists merely to enable it. The moment you try to cash out is the moment you stunt the growth of your movement. 5. Track your progress. Do it publicly and create pathways for your followers to contribute to that progress. And the principles. 1. Transparency really is your only option. Every failed televangelist has learned this the hard way. The people who follow you aren't stupid. You might go down in scandal, or more likely, from ennui. People can smell subterfuge from a mile away. 2. Your movement needs to be bigger than you. An author and his book, for example, don't constitute a movement. Changing the way people apply to college does. 3. Movements that grow thrive. Every day they get better and more powerful. You'll get there soon enough. Don't mortgage today just because you're in a hurry. 4. Movements are made most clear when compared to the status quo or to movements that work to push the other direction. Movements do less well when compared to other movements with similar goals. Instead of beating them, join them. 5. Exclude outsiders. Exclusion is an extremely powerful force for loyalty and attention. Who isn't part of your movement matters almost as much as who is. 6. Tearing others down is never as helpful to a movement as building your followers up. That building down the street. I think it's a boat club, but perhaps it's a political party or even a corporate headquarters. It might even be a franchise business or a local nonprofit. All I know is that there's a tribe working overtime to maintain the status quo. The congregation shows up every week and does the same ritual it did last week, goes through the same motions, and nothing changes. In fact, nothing changes precisely because of the ritual. The tribe exists, apparently, to stamp out change. The customer service staff shows up and follows the handbook and treats every customer exactly the same and can't figure out why they're being disrespected in return. The volunteers go through the motions of supporting the nonprofit, but they're the same motions they've always gone through, and they're getting the same results they've always gotten. Some tribes are engaged in change. Many are not. And it doesn't matter whether it's a church or a corporation. The symptoms are the same. The religion gets in the way of the faith. Static gets in the way of motion. Rules get in the way of principle. People show up because they have to, not because they want to. Desire is defeated by fear, and the status quo calcifies, leading to the long, slow death of the stalled organization. It's so sad to watch, and it's so common. Leadership is the antidote, and it works in every building if you let it. Every tribe is a media channel. Time Magazine is a media channel. So are CNN and Yahoo. The advantage of traditional media channels is that they're available for rent. Send in some money and buy some time. The time gets you eyeballs or possibly even attention, and that attention might lead to sales. Google realized that every search, more than a billion a day, is a media channel as well, and they've profited by selling those channels one click at a time. Tribes are different. Tribes are the most effective media channels ever, but they're not for sale or rent. Tribes don't do what you want, they do what they want, which is why joining and leading a tribe is such a powerful marketing investment. How to be wrong. John Zogby, the successful pollster, was completely, utterly wrong about Al Gore in Florida by 10 points. And he was wrong about John Kerry and wrong about his prediction for the New Hampshire primaries in 2008. But notice that I said successful pollster, not disgraced pollster. If he wasn't willing to be wrong, he'd be unable to be right as often as he is. Isaac Newton was totally, fantastically wrong about alchemy, the branch of science he spent most of his career on. He was as wrong as a scientist could be. And yet, he's widely regarded as the most successful scientist and mathematician ever. Steve Jobs was wrong about the Apple III, wrong about the next computer, wrong about the Newton, insanely wrong. You know the rest. The secret of being wrong isn't to avoid being wrong. The secret is being willing to be wrong. The secret is realizing that wrong isn't fatal. The only thing that makes people and organizations great is their willingness to not be great along the way. The desire to fail on the way to reaching a bigger goal is the untold secret of success. I've been waiting for you to ask for the shortcut, the error-free, failure-free way to get people to do what you want, to make change happen without risk or fear, to magically alter the status quo. That, after all, is the best way to sell you on the ideas here. If I could just give you the answer, you'd be leading a tribe right now. The honest answer is, there isn't an easy way. It isn't easy for middle managers or CEOs or heretics. The truth is that they appear to risk everything, but in fact, the risk isn't so bad. The downsides are pretty small, because few of us are likely to get burned at the stake. The secret of leadership is simple. Do what you believe in. Paint a picture of the future. Go there. People will follow. The timing of leadership. It's rare that it's obvious when to lead. Sure, there are times when you know you need to stand up, take a position, spread an idea, clear out an obstacle, and be brave. But more often than not, great leadership happens when the tribe least expects it. The non-obvious moments are the ones that count. Like now, perhaps. The reactionary tribe. So far, We've been talking about tribes as leadership-loving, fast-moving, progressive organizations that thrive on change. And most tribes, especially as they grow, are just that. But sooner or later, tribes get stuck. Let's look at Wikipedia again. Wikipedia is a nonprofit that's run by a conservative board and several thousand dedicated volunteers, and most of them don't want anything at all to change. In recent months, Wikipedia volunteers have gone on a campaign to delete tens of thousands of pages that don't meet the tribe's vague standards. At the same time, the chairwoman of the Wikipedia board is actively campaigning to ensure that no one makes particularly large donations to the foundation. She was quoted by the New York Times as saying that she would, quote, make some noise, unquote, if an aggressive outsider was to try to become a board member. What to do with a tribe like this? If your goal is to make change, it's foolish to try to change the worldview of the majority if the majority is focused on maintaining the status quo. The opportunity is to carve out a new tribe, to find the rabble-rousers and change-lovers who are seeking new leadership and run with them instead. Yes, I think it's okay to abandon the big, established, stuck tribe. It's okay to say to them, you're not going where I need to go, and there's no way I'm going to persuade all of you to follow me. So rather than standing here watching the opportunities fade away, I'm heading off. I'm betting some of you, the best of you, will follow me. Possibility of risk. I was listening to a talking head on the radio, and he was prattling on about a probability of risk related to some course of action in the future. People are so afraid of risk they can't even use the word. Risk, after all, is a probability of failure, right? So this guy was warning us of a probability of a probability. He couldn't even say it. It's all a risk. Always. That's not true, actually. The only exception, it's a certainty that there's risk. The safer you play your plans for the future, the riskier it actually is. That's because the world is certainly, definitely, and more than possibly, changing. When tribes replace what you're used to. The brilliant venture capitalist Fred Wilson got me thinking about what purpose a traditional firm, a corporation, a nonprofit, a church, whatever, serves. He quotes Ronald Coase, the Nobel laureate in economics, quote, there are a number of transaction costs to using the market. The cost of obtaining a good or service via the market is actually more than just the price of the good. Other costs, including search and information costs, bargaining costs, keeping trade secrets, and policing and enforcement costs, can all potentially add to the cost of procuring something with a firm. This suggests that firms will arise when they can arrange to produce what they need internally and somehow avoid these costs, unquote. In other words, we start formal organizations when it's cheaper than leading a tribe instead. Having employees, for example, gives you a tight interaction of communication and output that used to be difficult to accomplish from a less formal tribe. Having soldiers, for example, is seen as more reliable than earning the trust and support of the entire population. The internet changes this because you can build a bigger, faster, cheaper tribe than you used to be able to. The new economy changes this because the transaction costs are falling fast, while the costs of formal organizations, offices, benefits, management, keep increasing. Many big organizations are getting bigger as a way of fighting off the power of tribes. They buy other companies, hoping that the formal nature of their bigness will somehow successfully fight off the flexible, fast, and sometimes free power of the tribe. I think that's unlikely. Initiative. The timid leave a vacuum. Workers in the balloon factory are always afraid, particularly of something happening. Things that happen are rarely good because they disturb the status quo. That's why initiative is such an astonishingly successful tool. because it's rare. Even a little bit of action, a few new ideas, or a tiny bit of initiative can fill the vacuum. It's a big deal to spill just a few drops of Hawaiian punch on a spotless white tablecloth. People notice. When Barbara Barry, the now famous furniture designer, was looking for a manufacturing partner for her first line of sofas, she invited executives from a leading manufacturer to her showroom in Los Angeles. Before she did that, though, she took some initiative. First, she managed to place a wholesale order for reams of fabric that the manufacturer traditionally used on its own furniture. She rented an office big enough to turn into a showroom. She designed a line of furniture that was bold and even breathtaking, and then she had a local shop build one of each piece, upholstered in the company's signature fabric. When the executives arrived, expecting a sales pitch and some drawings, they saw finished sofas, made from their materials, with their brand label sewn on. After the fact, it's easy to say that it wasn't much, a few $1,000s worth of custom furniture. But in that moment, for that industry, it was more than enough. It changed the rules. Barbara wasn't managing her career or asking permission from the furniture executives. She was leading and enjoying every moment of it. The organizations that need innovation the most are the ones that do the most to stop it from happening. It's a bit of a paradox, but once you see it, it's a tremendous opportunity. Stuck on stupid. My colleague Gil likes to quote U.S. Army Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, pointing out that too many people get stuck on stupid. I'm imagining that your colleagues aren't stupid. But when the world changes, the rules change. And if you insist on playing today's games by yesterday's rules, you're stuck. Stuck with a stupid strategy because the world changed. Some organizations are stuck. Others move quickly. In a changing world, who's having more fun? Mark Rovner, nonprofit heretic. Mark has been challenging the status quo of the nonprofit world for years. He's very successful at it, and he's having a ball. Here's one example of the sort of trouble that leaders need to cause. Mark started an online debate about the future of direct mail fundraising. This income stream is the lifeblood of most nonprofits, and it's drying up. The internet, of course, is supposed to be the solution to all problems, but as Mark points out, it's not. I'm quoting here, "The era of cheap direct mail and high response rates and acquisitions is over. The economics of direct mail are failing. That is more or less an uncontroverted fact. It costs more to mail, and fewer new donors come back with each mailing. This trend has been masked somewhat by higher average gifts by donors you already have. But sooner or later, the acquisition crisis is going to affect bottom lines. For some, it already has. What currently passes for an online fundraising model is at best a stopgap." Unquote. My take. I despair for most of the top 50 nonprofits in the United States. These are the big guys, and they're stuck. Far more than the Fortune 500, not known for being cutting edge in themselves, the top charities rarely change. If you're big, you're used to being big, and you expect to stay big. That means that generation after generation of staff has been hired to keep doing what's working. Big risks and crazy schemes are certainly frowned upon. The good news is this. The internet is not a replacement for direct mail fundraising. It is, in fact, something much bigger than that for just about every nonprofit. As soon as commerce started online, many nonprofits generated lots of income from their websites. This was mistakenly chalked up to brilliant conversion and smart marketing. In fact, it was the result of technologically advanced donors using a more convenient method to send in money they would have sent in anyway. The big win is in changing the very nature of what it means to support a charity. The idea of "I gave at the office" and of giving money in the last week of December speaks to obligation. Many people donate to satisfy a guilty feeling or to please a friend. This doesn't scale, not one bit. It's super easy to ignore a direct mail solicitation when all you have to do is hit delete and no one notices. The big win is in turning donors into patrons and activists and participants. The biggest donors are the ones who not only give, but also do the work. The ones who make the soup or feed the hungry or hang the art. My mom was a volunteer for years at the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, New York, and there is no doubt at all that we gave more money to the museum than we would have if they'd sent us a flyer once a month. The internet allows some organizations to embrace long-distance involvement. It lets charities flip the funnel, not through some simple hand-waving, but by reorganizing around the idea of engagement online. This is the new leverage. It means opening yourself up to volunteers and encouraging them to network, to connect with one another, and yes, even to mutiny. It means giving every one of your professionals a blog and the freedom to use it. It means mixing it up with volunteers so they have something truly at stake. This is understandably scary for many nonprofits, but I am not so sure you have a choice. Do you have to abandon the old ways today? Of course not. But responsible stewardship requires that you find and empower the heretics and give them the flexibility to build something new, instead of trying to force the internet to act like direct mail with free stamps. The posture of a leader. If you hear my idea but don't believe it, that's not your fault, it's mine. If you see my new product but don't buy it, that's my failure, not yours. If you attend my presentation and you're bored, that's my fault too. If I fail to persuade you to implement a policy that supports my tribe, that's due to my lack of passion or skill, not your short-sightedness. If you're a student in my class and you don't learn what I'm teaching, I've let you down. It's really easy to insist that people read the manual. It's really easy to blame the user, student, prospect, customer for not trying hard, for being too stupid to get it, or for not caring enough to pay attention. It might even be tempting to blame those in your tribe who aren't working as hard at following as you are at leading. But none of this is helpful. What's helpful is to realize that you have a choice when you communicate. You can design your products to be easy to use. You can write so your audience hears you. You can present in a place and in a way that guarantees that the people you want to listen will hear you. Most of all, you get to choose who will understand and who won't. Switching tribes. As your tribe grows, it's tempting to accelerate that growth, to find more people to join the tribe. The most obvious prospects, of course, are already members of other tribes. If you can persuade that rabid soccer fan to switch to football instead, it's a coup. Or consider the full-page ad in the New York Times, paid for by hundreds of evangelical Christians, encouraging religious Jews to switch teams. And there goes a politician, eagerly courting the loudest partisans from the other side to join her team instead. This rarely works. People don't like to switch. We may eagerly join a company and slog through a job for years, staying until the place finally declares bankruptcy. No, it's not the same company we joined at the beginning, far from it, but to switch sides is to admit that we made a mistake. Growth doesn't come from persuading the most loyal members of other tribes to join you. They will be the last to come around. Instead, you'll find more fertile ground among seekers, among people who desire the feeling they get when they're part of a vibrant, growing tribe, but who are still looking for that feeling. I'm not talking about disaffected outsiders, loners who work hard not to affiliate. I'm talking about people at the fringes, individuals who might jump from one thing to another with less angst. If you're trying to persuade the tribe at work to switch from one strategy to the other, don't start with the leader of the opposition. Begin instead with the passionate individuals who haven't been embraced by other tribes yet. As you add more and more people like these, your option becomes safer and more powerful. Then you'll see the others join you.